Centre at six. It's just been confirmed by the Football Association that England will have to compete in the World Cup without their captain Rio Ferdinand. He picked up a left knee injury during training in South Africa. Former England skipper Brian Robson had to pull out of the 1986 tournament with a shoulder problem. He says there's plenty of cover at the back.
Injuries happen in football. It's unfortunate, and you know, it's unfortunate for Rio, but now Michael Dawson, Nedley King, Matthew Upson, you know, they get their chance.
Police have revealed Cumbria gunman Derek Bird killed 10 of his 12 victims in little more than an hour. Chief Constable Craig Mackey says his rampage began with the murders of his twin brother David and solicitor Kevin Commons. He then embarked on a 45-mile round trip, killing another 10 times before taking his own life. Mr. Mackey says it was a race against time to stop him.
From what we know, at no stage did any police officer have a chance to end this any sooner.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister's been to Cumbria to visit some of the victims of Wednesday's shooting. David Cameron's described locals as incredibly brave. A chef's been jailed for at least 20 years for killing his wife with a griddle pan and hiding her body in a freezer for 3 years. Peter Wallner thought Melanie stood in the way of his womanising. Her body was later found in a wheelie bin. Thousands of British telecom workers could be about to walk out after the company failed to meet a union deadline for increasing a pay offer. The Communication Workers Union's accusing BT of double standards after awarding large bonuses to some bosses. The company, which recently announced profits of over £1 billion, says industrial actions in nobody's interest. Prince William has praised the indomitable spirit of British forces as he celebrated the opening of a new complex at the military's top rehabilitation centre. The forces charity Help for Heroes raised millions of pounds to help provide the facilities at Headley Court in Surrey. It features a swimming pool, two gyms and a research centre. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Our services. Don't miss the opportunity. If you are employed and do extra hours work, bank shifts or overtime, including a second job, you are likely to have overpaid taxes. If you don't fall into any of these categories, you are still likely to have overpaid taxes based on your job expenses. We act as tax agents and can claim back £800 to £1,100 and up to £3,000 if you have never claimed before. Telephone 0845 544 0834. Visit marnor.net. M-A-R-N-O-R. Email admin@marnor.net.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back. Now, two Bristolians caught up in this week's attack on a flotilla of small ships, much-needed medical and building aid from Turkey over to Gaza, and it was difficult not to make the comparison with the Dunkirk anniversary commemorations. We hear in a minute from Dr. Judith Brown, who's an expert on the media coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict, who lives in North Somerset. And, well, BBC Online called it the world's most powerful secret society. And it's the annual Bilderberg weekend this weekend. This year it's in Spain. That is royalty, the IMF, the World Bank, Henry Kissinger, and maybe the new Lord Chancellor, Kenneth Clark. Or are they a modern-day version, as some people say, of the medieval Venetian black nobility? Anyway, they're meeting behind closed doors in Spain, with the media kept usually pretty much at least a mile away. And I'm joined on the line by Charlie Skelton, who wrote some reports for The Guardian last year and is doing the same this year. Hi, Charlie. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can. Hello.
So can you tell us what's been happening at the Bilderberg meeting so far over the last couple of days?
Well, the main thing that's been happening is that the press have turned up, actually physically on the ground, or they've started covering it a little bit more. I mean, genuinely, when I compare it with Voudegmini in Greece last year, there was very, very little written about it. But this year, you know, there's film crews, there's newspapers, and there's just a lot more buzz this year, and a lot more people.
So are you doing any sort of placard waving, or are you simply reporting on what's happening?
I haven't yet waved a placard. I fully intend to before the weekend is out. But there is a lot of placard waving, and there's quite a good relationship between the wavers of placards and the policemen standing in front of them, and it seems like they've chosen a slightly odd place to hold this meeting, because the Catalonians are a fiercely independent people, and they are not not fans of overlords. And the Catalonian policemen that we've been dealing with have been, generally speaking, extremely nice, and from my experience, a whole lot less scary than they were in Greece.
And now, for at least 50 years, the Bilderbergers have successfully kept these meetings, which include, as I said, royalty, some of the most powerful financiers in the Western world, if not the most powerful, plus a smattering of politicians. How is it, do you think, that, or has it been revealed this year who is actually in the meeting? Has it been easy to find who's been going in and out?
Well, veteran builder botherer Jim Tucker has come out. He's got about 15 or so names, which I half overheard him a second ago in the hotel, and the name that sprang out was Bill Gates. But we got a dozen names, which we published yesterday on The Guardian, from the hotel. We stayed at the hotel a couple of nights before lockdown, and we were able to obtain about a dozen names, and they're big names. And the one that stood out for me was Marcus Agius, or Agius, I don't know how to say it, A-G-I-U-S, and he is the chairman of Barclays and the new senior non-executive director of the BBC. So it's good to know the BBC at least got someone on the ground here.
Well, the weird thing is, a lot of the people, I mean, I've been to these meetings back in 2003 and in the year 2000. It's weird because quite a lot of the figures that are there, most people, although they're some of the most powerful people in Europe, or the NATO zone anyway, no one's actually recognises them.
I know, it's well, even more extraordinary than that is that when I've been ringing up a few news agencies and news corporations to simply try and drum up a bit of interest in the story and to make it so that I'm, or try and make it so that I'm not the only mainstream journalist here, and the number of times I've got through to people on the foreign desk of, let's say, I won't name any, but news corporations, and I'm talking about big names here, and you get through and you say, you know, I'm here covering the Bilderberg conference, and the answer is, the what? The Bilder, what? Who? And I'm thinking, what? What on earth are you doing? Well, you think, do you not know about this? But in fact, the conspiracy of ignorance is quite extraordinary, and I there's probably a wrong term to say conspiracy of ignorance, but the ignorance generally about Bilderberg is breathtaking and quite scary, and let's just hope that ignorance is gradually melting away, and as the lens of the internet particularly keeps getting shined upon it.
Now, they argue, of course, that it's just a private club, and why on earth shouldn't people be able to meet at a little private club in private?
Yeah, if they're private individuals, go for it. You know, if the CEO of Deutsche Bank wants to meet with Bill Gates and play ping pong, then he can do that for 365 days of the year, 24 hours a day, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, when cabinet ministers are turning up, when MPs, elected officials are there, and when those elected officials are gliding in blackened limos and being whisked into underground car parks as they were this year, and when they lie to Parliament about having been there, like Tony Blair did, when this sort of thing happens, and you know, there's the Finnish, we one of the names we obtained was Finland's Minister of Finance, and you know, if I was a Finn, I would be wanting to know what he spoke about, what was strategized, and you know, what part to play this meeting had in the financial future of Finland. So yes, I'd be interested.
Yeah, the other thing, of course, is that Goldman Sachs are quite well known as the most friendly bankers to Bilderberg, and their Goldman Sachs representatives have been at almost all the meetings that I've covered over the last 10, 12 years. I think all of them, I don't know if they're there this year, I mean, Goldman Sachs are currently under investigation for fraud. Do you think there's a case for the police just rounding up the people in the hotel and asking them questions about their culpability in the financial crisis?
Well, that would be very nice, because, I mean, there's certainly enough police here. They could simply just turn on their heels, turn around, and start walking up the hill instead of down the hill. I don't know if that's going to happen. But, do you know, arrests is one thing. I mean, you know, obviously, I'm sure there's a lot of culpability there, but simply people declaring that they have been. I mean, you know, and simply a relationship with the press. You know, that would be a start. You know, then, you know, from there, other things might happen, but you know, just I think that's what a lot of people here want, is simply a relationship with the press and with the public, because you know, these are big issues being discussed by big men mainly men, with you know, an agenda which affects us all. And present there are, I keep saying, because it's obviously the principal point here is these decisions are being made and these strategies are being formed with elected officials. And, you know, if this thing goes on in secret, why not just hold government in secret? You know, let's just all be North Korean.
Okay, Charlie, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
And now, Martin. Martin, what are your thoughts about the Bilderberg? Because I know one of the main people involved in the setting up of it was this chap, David Rockefeller. He's the supposed to be, anyway, the richest man in the United States. He owns something called the Chase Manhattan Bank, and his family are famous for the Standard Oil Company, which was one of the biggest cartels ever in the United States that had to be broken up by the U.S. government into lots of different sections because it was starting like an octopus to take over the entire economy. So what about the motives behind it? What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's not that crazy to imagine that people, wealthy movers and shakers, want to get together and have a strategy session. But I think, as Charlie pointed out, what's very disturbing is the elected officials being there. We know that business people get together to strategize. We can hardly prevent that. But elected officials are supposedly accountable, and going to these secret meetings without telling people that they are going there is very, very suspicious. I think what's very interesting, though, this year is that the media have started to pay attention to Bilderberg for the very first time. I mean, Charlie was the only reporter, I understand, from mainstream media at last year's Bilderberg conference. This year, the mainstream media are covering it, and you yourself were on Russia Today earlier, Russian TV program, talking about it. I think that Bilderberg has been outed, basically. People now realise that this is where the financial and political elite get together once a year to, not so much to strategize, I think, as to build solidarity around already agreed policies. And of course, what's really important is what are they discussing in these conclaves. Most of what they're discussing is in the interests of the wealthy. We haven't got many trade union leaders, for example, or community activists being invited to Bilderberg.
Well, we're going to hear now from author and investigative journalist Daniel Esterlin, who's author of several books on the Bilderbergers, one called Just Bilderberg and another one called The Shadow Masters.
I found out over almost 20 years of research that what today is called the Bilderberg Group already existed over 800 years ago. They were back then called the Venetian Black Nobility. In fact, Bilderberg is the creation of the Synarchy Movement of Empires, who are the plenipotentiary founders and financiers of Hitler. And Synarchy International, they in turn were founded by the Martinist Freemason Esoteric Secret Society back in the 1770s as a kind of counter attack on the principles upon which the United States of America was built. So again, it's a lot of people speak of Bilderberg as a domain of conspiracy theories. Of course, it's not. It's a historical fact. And again, what's today called Bilderberg 800 years ago existed. It was called back then the Venetian Black Nobility. Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of people believe that Bilderberg is about one world government or creating the new world order, especially if people point out to speech made by George W. Bush back in the 1990s about the creation of one world government. It's not about that at all. It's a meeting of people who represent a particular ideology. That ideology is of money. So the idea is not to create one world government, but rather the creation of one world company limited, where the financial concerns are far more powerful than any government on earth. And we're seeing right now, as evidence, very, very simple. In Europe, we had nation states. We had countries with our own constitutions, our own flags, our own currencies, our own monetary policies. And now we don't have any of that. The entire Europe is being led and directed through Brussels. In that sense, Spain, where I live, has a currency. We lost it. We had a constitution. That's now subordinate to the European constitution. Spanish flag is no longer ours. It's the European flag with little stars. And of course, the monetary policy is decided somewhere else. And we can see what they're doing, and Greece is a very good example of that destruction we're witnessing, and Spain of course is going to be the next country to go.
So why was the European Parliament so interested in hearing about your findings, and what reaction did you get?
Well, actually, the European Parliament was profoundly upset that I'm here. I was invited by Liga Norte, by Mario Borghesio, one of the senior European representatives from Italy, who came across Bilderberg, actually, in the Italian version of my book about 8 months ago. Well, he didn't know that these people existed, and the fact that some of the key decision-making process over the past 6 years were taken at Bilderberg obviously surprised and astonished him. And so through him, I was invited to make a speech, a historic speech, in fact, at the European Parliament about the Bilderbergers and their roots, which was called Bilderberg Towards One World Company Limited. Well, this is the old NATO alliance. So you're talking about the European presidents, Prime Minister of Canada, the sitting president of the United States, top 50, 60 CEOs of the world's leading corporations, American senators and congressmen, European commissioners, all of the European royalty, of course, is present. And finally, you know, talking about as well the leading bankers, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the European Central Bank, the World Bank. And finally, they're joined, and we have a lot of noise. I hope you can still hear me. We're joined at this one big table in the Bilderberg Conference by the leading representatives of world media, such as New York Times, Washington Post. And the fact that you have 120 of these mammoth representatives in one room, and the fact that the press never ever reports on them until my book came out, by itself is astonishing.
What impact do you think that your findings and your speech that you gave to the European Parliament will have on the group, if any?
Well, I'm hoping it's going to be, you know, an effect of an atomic bomb going off right in the middle of the parliament. A lot, obviously not literally, but figurative. The point is that Borghesio, that's Liga Norte group, is getting hundreds of calls from curious Italian media representatives who actually have never heard of Bilderbergers themselves. And so they want to know exactly how the decisions made at this very private organization fit into the world scheme. And Russia, in this particular sense, is very much a part of it or victim of it. As I reported back in 2005, by the summer 2008, Bilderbergers at their meeting talked about pushing the oil price to about $150 a barrel, and then they decided to push the oil price down, orchestrating it fall to about $30 a barrel, and it directly affects Russia because, again, China and Russia are the two main enemies of the people who are trying to create this one-world government, and Russia having a lot of oil. If you can actually destroy the oil price and push it down, you're destroying Russia's economy, and China, on the other hand, which has no oil to speak of, anything you make requires a lot of oil. So by pushing the oil price, by orchestrating, you know, the price at $147.5 a barrel, you're destroying the Chinese economy. So yes, Russia has, needless to say, has been on the receiving end of the Bilderberger planning and scheming.
That was Daniel Estelin there, author of a book on the Bilderberg group, or the Bilderberg Club, which is having its conference over in Spain, a secret conference this weekend, surrounded by press around about a mile away, peering towards the hotel, wondering what's being discussed. Now, Martin, I wonder if you could just take a guess. What are the kings and queens of Europe and the heads of finance talking about in Spain today?
Well, I should imagine it's the financial people that are calling the shots. They'll be talking about what the future ahead is for the global economy, and they'll be strategizing for what they would like to see happen.
Now, George Osborne went to last year's conference, so what does that tell us about what their strategy might be?
Well, the strategy is fairly obvious. It's let's cut back public expenditure in the hopes of resurrecting private capitalism. I think that is unlikely to work for the reasons that I've often made clear on this programme. But essentially, this group doesn't include the Russians, it doesn't include the Chinese, doesn't include anybody else outside the charm circle. As the contributor there was just saying, the manipulations of things like the oil price, decisions about what to do with the dollar, all of these kind of things will be the sort of things that they'll be discussing.
So he was talking about there, Danny Estlin was saying, One World Company Limited. So is this the cartel of cartels?
When people talk about one world government and the new world order and all these kind of slogans that people use, they're forgetting that this is very much the Western political elite. It doesn't include the Russians and it doesn't include the Chinese. So what we've actually got is a geopolitical contest. You know, Eurasia, East Asia and whatever. In 1984, there were three big blocks. There are three big blocks.
Now, the thing that, as a footnote to all this, the thing that alerted me to it all was the fact that the founder of the Bilderbergers back in 1954, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, was himself an SS officer in the run-up to the Second World War. He then married into the Dutch royal family during the war, and you might say that he gave up any inclination to be a supporter of the Nazis and the SS. But actually, it's been exposed by Radio 4's document series that he was, when he was chairman of KLM Royal Dutch Airlines after the World War II, was helping to run Nazi criminals who had been sprung from jail over to South America. So it seems that the guy that founded this organisation really was a Nazi through and through. So that's one of the reasons I always feel that the Bilderberg Group deserves a bit more press scrutiny. Now, on to our next topic for the second hour, and two Bristolians were caught up in this week's attack on a flotilla of small ships taking much-needed medical and building aid from Turkey and from Cyprus over to Gaza. Marina Morris reports.
Today I am contrasting and giving some background to the conflict between Israel and Palestine. There is international disagreement over the status and even what to call the Palestinian territories. They are widely viewed as a consisting of two territories, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The areas were occupied by a coalition between Egypt and Transjordan in the late 1940s, but were captured and occupied by Israel in 1967 during the Six-Day War. According to the terms of the Oslo Accord of 1993, portions of each territory are governed to a limited and varying extent by Palestinian authorities. Israel claims that East Jerusalem is not part of the West Bank and falls fully under Israel's jurisdiction and law. No other country has recognized the sovereignty claim. International law prohibits the unilateral annexation of territory. Some Arabs use the terms Israel-occupied territories, occupied Palestine, to include the land now called by many Israel, to which they claim historical rights. Many Israelis object to these terms, and some even use terms like Greater Israel to include the Palestinian territories. The sovereignty of this land can perhaps best be described and disputed. When the Islamic movement Hamas won a majority of seats in election for the Palestinian parliament in January 2006, Israel, supported by the United States, instituted an economical blockade of the Gaza Strip. According to the CIA World Factbook, the unemployment rate in Gaza is around 40%, with 70% of the population living below the poverty line. This about 2/3 of Gaza electricity imported from Israel. This compares this unemployment rate in Israel of 7.4% and 23.6% of the population of Israel living below the poverty line. There are, of course, Palestinians living in Israel. According to the same sources, the UK has 8% unemployment, this 14% of population living below the poverty line. Ukraine has 4.8% unemployment and 35% of population living below the poverty line. Gaza's population is a little over 1.6 million, growing at 3.6% per year, despite a high and increasing infant mortality rate due to the high birth rate. The average woman has around 5 children. By contrast, Israel population is around 7.3 million, which include 0.3 million Israel settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The population is growing by 1.6% per year. The average Israeli woman has 2.7 children. Infant mortality is less than a quarter of that experienced in Gaza.
Thanks very much, Marina. Well, Monday's events in the Mediterranean were shocking, to see armed commandos with guns blazing storming on board the flotilla of small aid ships in the early hours of the morning was truly shocking. So doesn't the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu care what the world thinks anymore? Does he think he can spin Israel as the victim in events like this? Well, to ask some of these questions and look at the prospects for peace in the region, where tension and mistrust seem to be the only rule right now, is Dr. Judith Brown, who lives in North Somerset. Hello, Judith, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, you did your PhD in the media coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Why did you choose that topic?
Well, I'd been working in South Lebanon in 1995, and when I went there, I knew absolutely nothing about the Middle East. And because I was able to view for myself what was happening there, it was very different from what I expected to happen. Because of that, I did a lot of reading and a lot of research, and I came to the conclusion that I'd been deceived about the coverage of Middle East issues, and I wanted to look further into those issues.
So can you tell us some of the distortions that you found?
Well, for example, when I was in South Lebanon, I went there thinking that Hezbollah was a terrorist group and Israel was defending itself. And when I got there, I found, I think that it's probably well known now, but then it wasn't well known, that Hezbollah was taking part in elections, was providing health and social services. And also I noted what Israeli occupation meant. I actually heard bombs falling. I met women who'd been sheltering in their house and had seen their children killed in front of them. And also I saw that there were joint operations between the Israeli army and Hezbollah from time to time reported on the news. I also saw that I spoke to various people who had contact with Hezbollah, and they were saying that they were really impressed with them because they weren't corrupt. And also when we spoke to the UN forces that were stationed in that area, they were very critical of Israeli policies in South Lebanon region.
Now, what about this thing that Marina was talking about the birth rate? That's something I'd not heard about before. A much, much higher birth rate. Five children per family in Gaza, we're hearing, whereas only just about 2.5 in Israel itself.
Well, I think if you look at the statistics in the world in general, where you've got high rates of poverty, you tend to have a higher birth rate for various reasons. You know, women can't get employment and don't have opportunities. I suppose people feel that so they need to have a high birth rate because there's a chance that, you know, their children will die, and they don't have pensions, so they see that as a chance to maybe have children, educate them, maybe they'll be able to leave the territories and go and work overseas and send money back to them. And so all of these factors encourage them to have a higher birth rate. And I don't think this is exclusive to Palestine. I think in most countries that have a highly impoverished population, you have a high birth rate.
So anyway, getting back to the media coverage, how is it, do you think, that the media coverage is skewed? Because there was a report about, I think, 2 years ago by the BBC into their coverage of the Middle East politics, which was then actually not published.
Yes, Malcolm Barland's report. This is true. And I did myself ask to see this report, but I think at the time a solicitor from London who had sympathies with Israel had also made a submission under the Freedom of Information Act. In fact, it's never been shown the contents of that report have never been shown, but there was a further independent study done by an independent organisation for the BBC, which did conclude that there were some sort of like misrepresentations. There have also been other studies. I mean, the notable one, there was the one done by Glasgow University, Bad News from Israel, which really showed that ordinary people in UK don't know what the term occupation means. You know, a toilet's occupied, you know, and they don't have any idea. And people thought that, you know, Israelis and Palestinians were, you know, had a little bit of a struggle over a nice bit of land, and they were equal in terms of, you know, power and strength. So all of these things have been shown in various research to be distorted in the past.
But it is difficult for the media, isn't it? Because the idea is that they have to put both sides, the Israelis may be actually quite a lot better at getting their message across.
I think that's absolutely true. But I think that when you have hegemonic influence, you're more likely to get a coherent message. message, you know, whether I like it or not, you know, George Bush and Obama are the spokespersons for the Western world, and the news tends to follow that line. The difficulty is for people that are opposing the hegemonic line, you have a situation where you've got sort of like disparate people. Like, for example, if you take the situation relating to the Iraq war, you've got people like the Green Party and the National Front both opposing the war for different reasons. Well, they weren't likely to unite under one banner, and this is sort of like the issue when you've got people who are opposing power. The focus is very difficult, and if you have someone who becomes effective as a spokesperson or appears to be sort of like, you know, doing quite well, if the other part, if the other side don't like them, then they tend to knock them. I mean, take the issue of Arafat. He was actually a peace laureate, you know, and had sort of done quite a lot to develop a potential state of Palestine. But when he didn't sign the Camp David Accords and wasn't able to proceed to a situation that Israel and their allies America saw as the solution, then he was then demonized and made out to be a terrorist. No one would call him president, whereas they call Abbas president now, because he's much more compliant with the view of the Western powers.
And Martin, let's just bring you in on this, because I mean, you're obviously an avid internet scourer. What are your views on some of the better or worse sources of news on the Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, obviously, Robert Fisk, based in Beirut, has been a pretty fierce critic of the kind of distortions.
And that he Judith writes for The Independent, doesn't he?
Yeah, he writes for The Independent, of the kind of distortions that Judith has been highlighting. I think that there's a plethora of sources out there now. I mean, I don't have to recommend any particular source, because, I mean, if you read the English language press from Beirut, you get a very different picture of what's going on in the world than you would if you just read the English language press from England.
But we don't, do we?
Well, we can do now. This is the beautiful thing about the internet. There's an English language press in virtually every country in the world, and if you start reading, I mean, the Asia Times, which is based in Singapore. A very good source of news about the world. I read a lot of the Pakistani English language press, and we are very lucky in this country that there is an English language press everywhere. And if you want to know other people's points of view, it's a click away. But we've got to educate ourselves, not just to listen to official sources and to find our official sources, but to listen to all of the plethora of voices that are out there. And then, of course, you get a much more balanced view of what's going on.
Can I ask you the same question then, Judy? Can you give us some ideas of maybe not very good news outlets with regards balance in the conflict, and then point us towards some that maybe that you use?
Yeah, well, Just to follow on from what Martin was saying about the international news, I think that when you look at the Israeli press, you see a far more vibrant arguments. I mean, you've got some journalists such as Amira Hasgedi and Levi who write in Haaretz, and the things that they say in the press in Israel are never said in the press over here. They're far more sort of like cutting into the points and critical of the Israeli government. But those sorts of criticisms never come into our media. I mean, for example, I did one study which looked at how the death, it was a time of the Intifada when there was a lot of suicide bombs in Israel, and there were a lot of children killed on both sides. In fact, far more children killed on the Palestinian side than on the Israeli side. But nonetheless, I looked at how those deaths had been reported in the newspaper, and you found that the Israeli children were more likely to be named. The grief of their families was more likely to be expressed. The positive characteristics of those children was more likely to be put forward, and also things like, for example, the number of words was actually about 10 times more per death. Often Palestinian deaths were sort of like a tag on following an article about Palestinian terrorism, so it was sort of like the other side of the story. But what was quite interesting was this: when you counted up how each newspaper reported it, I expected to see a difference between, for example, The Guardian and The Times. I looked even at The Morning Star. But what I actually found was that across the whole spectrum of newspaper, there was this, in terms of reporting the Palestinian children's deaths, you had very similar coverage in across the whole spectrum. And that surprised me because I expected to see it differently. I also spoke to various people who were involved with sort of like Palestinian news management, and certainly you know, you could really see the weakness. I mean, for example, I interviewed Michael Tarazi, who is an excellent spokesman, but as he said, when people started realizing that he was a really good spokesman for the Palestinians axed him. They wouldn't use him again. The same with Diane Bhutto, the same with Hanan Ashrawi. All of the internal battles between the Palestinians, I mean, they're very concerned about sort of like rising stars and sort of like cut them off so that they can't become more powerful than the persons in charge.
Why is that? Yeah, but why is that though?
Well, I think that it's just because the, say, for example, you know, people are very, who are in charge in Palestine feel sort of like very vulnerable, and therefore they don't want to see anybody coming up and threatening their own particular position.
Can I also say that the Israeli security services have fomented these divisions and certainly play upon the divisions between the different wings of the Palestinian movement? They're playing the old imperial tactic of divide and rule.
But do you have any evidence for that?
I think Abbas has been definitely... look at what happened when Hamas took over in Gaza. It was Dahlan, who was the head of the Palestinian Security Services, who was about to carry out a coup against Hamas. And Hamas moved because Dahlan was going to move against them. And Dahlan was very close to Mossad and close to the Americans. Now, you've got to remember that all movements have, you know, traitors and sellouts within them, and the Palestinian movement has been bedeviled by this, and of course the Israelis love this, where you've got the people fighting each other so that you don't have to bother, and there are divisions there which are natural, as it were, between the different factions, but the Israelis love to fish in these troubled waters. It's one of their main strategies.
In fact, you could see when you look at issues how far Israeli and American influence infiltrates the Palestinians. For example, the Palestinians had this program. Some British journalists went out to help the Palestinians develop their own media coverage so that they could make it sort of like more appropriate and more useful. But it was actually funded by Israel. Somebody said, "Well, look, there's been a suicide bomber. Let's issue a press release showing that the sort of life that this suicide bomber has had, you know, his family had been killed and so on and so forth." And the Palestinians said, "Oh, no, no, we can't do that," and wouldn't do it. You know, they tried to sort of like get them to show a woman having a house demolished and put out a press report of it. They wouldn't do that. The use of the word Zionism was totally forbidden. And this is amongst the Palestinians. And the reason why was because their program to improve their media coverage was actually funded by Israel. Well, you know, I mean, that was just a crazy situation. So therefore you find that you don't get sort of like effective management of the media, and there's just very complex reasons for it.
I'm going to try and pin you down though. Whereabouts do you get your news from the region from? Because I mean, I think it's always, you know, rather than complaining about bias, and a lot of people have actually complained to the BBC about the original coverage of this on Monday, which very much put forward an official Israeli point of view. Where is a good place to go for unbiased coverage on what's going on in particularly in this Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, I think like Martin, I very often find that the best sort of news sources available are actually from the internet, and you can go to sort of like the media in different countries. You can look at sort of like personal accounts.
Well, we've heard about Haaretz, which is an Israeli newspaper, which is quite good. What about other good sources actually coming from the Middle East itself?
Well, there's some good newspapers in Lebanon, and in fact one of the top reporters in Lebanon, Rami Khoury, he's a patron of an advisor to Arab Media Watch, and I follow his articles quite fully.
What is Arab Media Watch?
Arab Media Watch is an organisation. It's a British organisation, and it's designed to sort of like analyse the coverage of Arab issues, not just Palestinian issues, but Arab issues in general in the British media, and where they see a bias or where they see unfair coverage or inaccuracies, then they bring it to the attention of the media as far as possible. They use the, things like the PCC, the appeal bodies at the...
That's the Press Complaints Commission.
Yeah, Press Complaints Commission.
Well, I'm afraid they're notoriously not very good.
Well, actually, yeah, the PCC are very helpful as an organisation,
yeah.
but they don't have power. But within the confines of the limitations of what they do, they actually try very hard. So, you know, I would say they don't have power, but they are a very helpful organisation, and several times they've really helped us to sort of ensure that the corrections have actually appeared in the newspapers.
Can I just ask a question? I understand, I mean, maybe you can confirm this for me, Judith, that the Israeli government employs people as bloggers who sit and blog onto the internet, for example, where they identify articles which are critical of Israel and then bombard the editors with hostile hostile criticism, which of course means editors are then constantly on guard against this. I mean, obviously...
But Martin, don't all campaigners do this?
I mean, I'm talking about official Israeli government, and the Israeli government paying for these people to do this. It's not just kind of random people wading in. It's a kind of a concentrated strategy.
Yeah. You do see people, posts being advertised to work with the Israeli governments in their press office, and they do have quite a large sort of like paid press office. I'm not exactly sure, and I've never been able to find out exactly what they do in that office, whether they are bloggers or whether they just you know, go through every single television program, radio program, every single newspaper in order to pick out arguments, or whether they actually do direct blogging. I think there is a lot of blogging done, but whether that's paid or not, I've never been able to sort of like establish those links. And of course a lot of the bloggers originate in America, as you probably know.
Well, it's just difficult to pin this down, isn't it? But I mean, certainly editors, as you will know, Tony, editors are very, very aware of, if they're going to be critical of Israel, they know they're going to get a post bag of people saying you're being totally, you know, a negative post bag from that quarter.
Yeah, and another...
Which, of course, leads to timidity.
Another inclination of editors towards timidity is legal threats. So, you know, if there's any kind of legal threats, they may be. And I don't know if you have any evidence of that, Judith, as one side or other in the conflict being better at threatening legal action over the way things are reported?
Well, of course, there was the very big and public argument between the BBC and the Israeli government. I mean, the BBC is in a very particular position, I think, because it's seen as a purveyor of truth, and it's very targeted by Israel, because obviously if you see something as, if the public sees something as truthful, then they want to put their influence over it sort of like very strongly. But there was the issue of the spat between the BBC and Israel over, I think, the weapons of mass destruction, and I think it was about the nuclear program in the Negev Desert, and that resulted in sort of the Israeli government banning the BBC from its offices in Jerusalem. Now, I think this is
the Israelis' own nuclear weapon program.
Yes, that's right, and because they were banned, that meant that it was very all of the Middle East coverage by the BBC is centered on Jerusalem. So therefore, once they were banned from there, it became very difficult for them to complete their whole Middle East coverage program, and ultimately the BBC had to back down, and you never see anything now on their nuclear program. So there are these threats. In terms of individual people, I think that you know, I've spoken to many sort of like journalists who talk about you know, for example, I spoke to one person who was a bulletin writer, and I don't know whether you'd call this a legal threat, but it's an issue. And I think after a suicide bombing, they normally have put three questions, you know, and he put one question, where was it, what happened, and then the third question was, well, why did these suicide bombers do this? And along came the editor and crossed out that question, and he said, well, So the bulletin writer, in fact, is Israeli. He's an Israeli person himself. He said, "Well, why can't I ask that question?" And the editor said, "We all know why they're suicide bombers. It's because they're fanatics." And so the question wasn't allowed to be asked. So, you know, now nobody's told the staff in the BBC that they should do this, but they automatically know, and this is the effect and the total control of hegemonic power. People know the rules. The rules don't have to be forced on. The rules aren't top down. The rules are everywhere at every level operating, and people know how they should behave. So almost you don't need the legal threat when you've got hegemonic power, because it's so much more powerful.
It's a kind of self-censorship,
yeah.
Isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we seem to be veering towards a Palestinian perspective a bit too much, so I want to bring Benjamin Netanyahu in here. And he made a speech earlier this week about the attack on the Gaza flotilla, which we're going to have a listen to now.
Once again, Israel faces hypocrisy and a biased rush to judgment. I'm afraid this isn't the first time. Last year, Israel acted to stop Hamas from firing thousands of rockets into Israel's towns and cities. Hamas was firing on our civilians while hiding behind civilians. And Israel went to unprecedented lengths to avoid Palestinian civilian casualties. Yet it was Israel, and not the Hamas, that was accused by the UN of war crimes. Now, regrettably, the same thing appears to be happening now. But here are the facts. Hamas is smuggling thousands of Iranian rockets, missiles, and other weaponry, smuggling it into Gaza in order to fire on Israel's cities. These missiles can reach Ashdod, Be'er Sheva. These are major Israeli cities. And I regret to say that some of them can reach now Tel Aviv and very soon the outskirts of Jerusalem. And from the information we have, the planned shipments include weapons that can reach farther, even farther and deeper into Israel.
Now, Judith and Martin, you can see where Benjamin Netanyahu's coming from here. Thousands of rockets being fired, Hamas committing war crimes, and possibly involvement of the Iranians too. What do you think of what Mr. Netanyahu had to say there?
Well, of course, it's Israel that's occupying Palestinian land and not the other way around. I mean, if he ends the occupation, then the dispute ends, you know, the conflict ends, and that wasn't said. But also, I think that it's well known that there have been ceasefires that have been negotiated between Hamas and Israel in the past, mostly use Egypt as the mediator. And in all of these instances, Hamas has kept to the ceasefire, but Israel hasn't. And of course, at the end of the last ceasefire before the 2009-2010 invasion, Hamas didn't renew the ceasefire because they'd been keeping to the ceasefire. Israel hadn't, and what's more, Israel didn't end the embargo, so there wasn't any sort of like reward for its good behaviour. And so therefore, when they say that they needed to end this by going in and dropping bombs on innocent civilians who weren't Hamas at all, there was an alternative. The alternative was to go back to the negotiating table and keep their side of the bargain.
Yeah, can I just contrast the treatment of Israel? I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia during the 1990s, and Israel in many ways is behaving like the Serbs behaved in Bosnia, which is they make ceasefires but they don't keep them. They are the aggressors, effectively. Not entirely, but it was more complicated than that. And eventually, of course, in Kosovo, as a result of what was going on in Kosovo, the Western powers said to Serbia, you back out of Kosovo or we're going to start an air campaign against your infrastructure. We're going to bomb your bridges. We're going to bomb your railway stations. We're going to bomb your television stations. Now, I suspect that the Turkish military might be looking at these kind of options, because if Israel is going to behave like Serbia, perhaps Israel is going to have to be treated like Serbia, and it won't necessarily be Hamas that's going to be doing the bombing.
Now we're going to have another listen to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu now, and now we're going to hear all about his worries, very real worries apparently, about the Iranians actually getting a port on the Mediterranean.
Under international law and under common sense and common decency, Israel has every right to interdict this weaponry and to inspect the ships that might be transporting them. This is not a theoretical challenge or a theoretical threat. We've already interdicted vessels bound for Hezbollah and for Hamas from Iran containing hundreds of tons of weapons. In one ship, the Frankhof, we found hundreds of tons of war material and weapons destined to Hezbollah. In another celebrated case, the Karine A, dozens of tons of weapons that were destined by Hamas or by Iran for shipment to Gaza. Israel simply cannot permit the free flow of weapons and war materials to Hamas from the sea. I would go further than that. Israel cannot permit Iran to establish a Mediterranean port a few dozen kilometers from Tel Aviv and from Jerusalem. And I'd go beyond that too. I say to the responsible leaders of all the nations, the international community cannot afford an Iranian port on the Mediterranean. 15 years ago, I cautioned about an Iranian development that has come to pass. People now recognize that danger.
That's the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, Martin, do you want to go first on this? Surely there is a legitimate fear there that this literally these weapons are going to be moving all around Israel, across the Mediterranean, backwards and forwards, straight into Iran if necessary. This is one of the reasons that he's felt it was so necessary to stop these boats coming towards Gaza.
If a state of war exists between Palestine and Israel, which is what the implication of what Benjamin Netanyahu is saying, the Palestinians are absolutely within their rights to fight to the best of their ability against the Israeli occupation of their country. International law is quite clear on this. The Palestinians have a clear right of resistance. Now, it may be difficult for them to get weapons in to their fighters. It was difficult for the Bosnian army in 1993, but they still had the right to defend themselves against aggression. Now, if Israel wants a war, then war it must be, and they must accept that it is a war, and then they've got to take everything that happens on the chin and not complain. Now, if they want peace, they can have peace. The whole basis of this is they won't recognise the elected government of Palestine, which is Hamas. Hundreds, correct me if I'm wrong, but scores at least of Hamas politicians, elected MPs, are in prison in Israel as we speak. The Israelis are not interested in having a conversation. If you're not interested in a conversation, you've got to have a war. And that means killing, not just other people, your people.
Yeah, I'd just like to confirm that. In fact, Even if it isn't a war, the people who are living under occupation under the Geneva Conventions, which are the rules of war, have the right to armed struggle. And what seems very strange to me is that we arm the occupier and the aggressor against the and we don't arm the oppressed and consider that when you do arm them that's wrong. But if you look at the situation of Hamas, Hamas will take weapons from anyone that will send them. They come along the tunnels, and there's the Turkish army had looked at the ships before they disembarked from Turkey, so therefore the chances of weapons being there was extremely remote. So if you look at the situation, Hamas, and who are a fundamentalist Sunni organisation, are not likely to be associated closely with a Shia country, which Iran is. Hamas takes the weapons from Iran because they're the only ones that will give them to them. So if in fact you the West gave weapons to Hamas or Egypt or anyone else, they would take them. They only take the weapons because they're there, not because there's
the Iranians. The Iranians and the Americans got together to frustrate the British army around Tuzla in the 1990s because the Iranians and the Americans were supplying the Bosnian army with weaponry. So we had the situation where the SAS are running around trying to stop the Iranians and the Americans cooperating to pass arms to the Bosnian army to fight the Serbs, because the Serbs were the aggressors. Now, perhaps the sort of pressure that needs to be put on Israel is not boycotts and disinvestment, although I agree with that. Perhaps we ought to start saying, well, never mind Iran arming Hamas, maybe we should arm Hamas, in which case then we will have some control over what they do with the weaponry we give. give them. Now, this all sounds completely impossible. We can't say things like that. But I'm just pointing out the total difference in the way we approach the war in Bosnia and the way we approach the war in Palestine. But there's a lot of similarities. Sharon, for example, did not support the Western intervention over Kosovo because he understood very well what the precedent was, which is that bully countries will be told to back off and made to back off.
Okay, we're going to hear from Benjamin Netanyahu again now, and this time about his troops, who he believes were actually met by a vicious mob when they descended, the commandos, that is, onto the boats.
Now, on five of the vessels, our seamen were not met by any serious violence, and as a result, there were no serious injuries aboard those ships. But on the larger ship, something very different happened. Our naval personnel, just as they landed on ship, you could see this in the videos, the first soldier, they were met with a vicious mob. They were stabbed, they were clubbed, they were fired upon. I talked to some of these soldiers. One was shot in the stomach, one was shot in the knee. They were going to be killed. And they had to act in self-defense. It's very clear to us that the attackers had prepared their violent action in advance. They were members of an extremist group that has supported international terrorist organization and today support the terror organization called Hamas. They brought with them in advance knives, steel rods, other weapons. They chanted battle cries against the Jews. You can hear this, some of this, on the tapes that have been released. This wasn't a love boat. This was a hate boat. These weren't pacifists, they weren't peace activists. These were violent supporters of terrorism.
Now, if the people on some of the, at least of the people on those boats, were violent supporters of terrorism, Judith, doesn't that really justify the actions of the Israeli military?
Well, first of all, I think that we really need a proper inquiry into this, and I'm rather disturbed that we haven't got an international inquiry, because I wasn't there, you weren't there, so how can we say exactly what happened? But I would like to be to have an international inquiry that was independent. As it is, I gather that the inquiry that's been planned is actually an Israeli inquiry, and I feel rather sad about that, although there was quite a good inquiry, the Kagan inquiry, about the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Lebanon. So I'm just hoping that that the inquiry is fair, but I somehow am concerned that it won't be.
That's Jabra and Shatila massacre. I've heard it mentioned quite a lot of times. Can you, in a nutshell, tell us what happened there?
Well, when the PLO fighters agreed to leave Lebanon, they left their women behind in two refugee camps in Beirut. And then under Ariel Sharon, the Israelis encircled the camp, and then they sent in this group called the Phalange that were a Christian group into massacre the women and children that were left behind once the male fighters had left.
Doesn't sound very Christian to me.
No, nor very Jewish either, because, you know, both are meant to be fair religions and just religions.
Okay, now, the other thing which has not really been reported so much, I hadn't heard anyway, was the absolute chaos in the Knesset yesterday. I don't know if you two have come across that. So we're going to hear now from the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, yesterday evening, late afternoon, I believe. Now, what you can hear there is total chaos in the Israeli Knesset, because it's quite clear that there were several Israeli, whatever the equivalent they have over there, of MPs, who were extremely upset about the action that Benjamin Netanyahu took in taking out these ships. What do you think about the way Israeli politics is reported over here, Judith?
Well, I think that in this country, I think it's very unlikely that you're going to get a really clear view of exactly what's happening in Israel. I mean, you've got people who are talking about transfer, you've got ethnic cleansing going on in East Jerusalem, you've still got sort of occupation, Zionism is in fact a racist policy. All of these things are never reported properly. The equality of the two sides are reported as if they're equal sides, whereas one is the fourth biggest army in the world and the other is just a people who are under occupation and just resisting that occupation.
But one of the things is we get off very often the official state line, but we're not ever really getting the debate that's going on behind that in the Israeli parliament.
Absolutely. And as I said, the debate that goes on in the Israeli media, we don't get it here. It doesn't happen. Everyone tends to, as I said, I think part of this is the hegemonic sort of the effect of hegemonic power where everyone follows one line over here and you just don't get the same debate. Actually, yesterday I gather in Parliament that one of the things that happened was that there was an Israeli MK who was of Palestinian origin that had been on the boat, and when she went into Parliament she was actually attacked and now has to have 24-hour security because people are threatening her with her life.
Well, fascinating stuff. Thanks very much, Dr. Judith Brown, for joining us on Drive Time this evening. That's all for this week. Coming up is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a guest for a future show, please go to our webpage at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, Liberal Democrat Councillor for Cotton, the new arrival on the City's Cabinet, Anthony Negus. Next week, Money Reform, and Bob Wellham from the Money Reform Party will be along after 6 to tell us all about how we need to change our money system. See you next week.
FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.